Is therapy ruining people's lives? Now, I know this is a hot take, or at least the idea of it is a hot take. I'm not necessarily saying that it's my take, but there's been an ongoing just kind of, you know, noise on the internet in this space, mainly started by Abigail Schreier, who you may know. She's a famous author and commentator on all things culture and issues, especially things that have to do with trans ideology and how we treat that, you know, issue and how we treat people who have gender dysphoria, etc. And so with all of this going on, I wanted to talk about this issue. I wanted to get somebody on to discuss it from a Catholic perspective. And so I brought on my friend, Jack Beers, who joins me for today's podcast episode. Now, Jack was my former boss at Dynamic Catholic, and we've known each other for about 5 years now, coming up on 5 years. And he's doing some great work over at thecatholicmentor.com. You can learn more about Jack's work, where he's helping people to have breakthroughs, emotional breakthroughs, mental breakthroughs in a lot of their difficult things and the lies that they've been told. So he works in the space of mental health. He was trained by Dr. Greg Bataro's program. Dr. Greg Bataro, of course, wrote The Mindful Catholic. And so some great stuff there. So he's got some interesting perspective on some of these issues and things that are going on, especially on this concept of therapy and how we are really coddling and sometimes ruining this generation, or our generation of millennials, and then the generation that came after us, the Gen Zers, how we can be messing them up with really just throwing people into endless therapy and just some of the negative aspects of that. So we're going to affirm and talk about some of the positive aspects of therapy, but we're also going to get into some of the downsides of it and where it can really go wrong. And so without further ado, let's get into today's episode. Amazing. You know, there's certain days in our lives where we are just blessed beyond belief. We have great friends with us. And today I have a good friend of mine joining the Seeking Excellence podcast for the first time. It's been a long time coming, but excited. And I think this is a great topic, obviously, to bring you on for. I'm excited to hear a little bit and to share a little bit of your story with our listeners as well. But want to welcome Jack Beers to Seeking Excellence. Jack, how are we doing, man?
I'm in privileged territory here. I've been absolutely privileged, terrible. I thought that, like, if I could hear Father Meyer for the 100th time on the podcast, I might be able to get in.
That's right. That was the mark you had to get.
The marker. Like, once Father Meyer hits number 100, I'll get in.
Yep. Exactly. So he unlocked it for you, and now here we are. And so would love for you to just share with everybody just a little bit about yourself. Obviously, to give people some of our personal context, we worked together at Dynamic Catholic a few years ago, very closely, have very fond memories of that. Still remember some of our trips to Kansas City and Austin and all kinds of crazy stuff, driving in that, what was that, Dodge Challenger? Do you remember the Dodge Challenger? Yeah, yes. Your favorite. And yeah, I think we had a lot of fun together. So would love to hear, just a little intro overview of your life up to this point.
Yeah, for sure. It's funny you say that about us working together, because I had this memory pop up on my phone, because it does that where it pops up memories of us. I think we were road tripping to Detroit to go spend some time with Pierce's in Detroit. And it was like 15 minutes into the drive into Detroit, and you're just straight passed out in the car seat next to me. And I remember sending it to the rest of the people, and I was like, great conversations with Nathan on the ride.
Let's go. That's very exciting.
Awesome. Now, the Dodge Challenger's, you know, or a Charger, you know, bump into some tunes, because you know, driver is the DJ. So I got to
just rip it down the highway.
Yeah.
In rural Missouri.
In rural. Yeah. No kidding. Rural Missouri. That was crazy. Remember we had to pick up a check because I was buying my house. Do you remember that? We had to drive like 45 minutes out of the way.
That's right. To a Wells Fargo.
So that I could put a deposit down on the house. Yeah.
That's right. I forgot about that.
Good times. But that's not what we came here to talk about. My conversion story, or my life in general. It's been a great ride so far. Grew up in God's favorite state on earth, New Jersey, the Garden State. Nothing better. God loves gardens, Nathan. He loves gardens.
He does.
Garden State, yeah. Twin, great parents. My dad's Jewish. My mom is Episcopalian. So people used to ask me all the time, like, your dad's Jewish, your mom's Episcopalian. What are you? Like, lucky. Hanukkah presents, Christmas presents. I get off for Jewish holidays. I get off for Christian holidays. I go to like 3% less school than every other human being.
That's true. Yeah. That is a gift.
And get like 10% more presents. It's a pretty great deal. I was bar mitzvahed at 13, which is cool. So I don't understand it, but I can read Hebrew, which is awesome. And then when I was 17, I went to a Catholic church for the first time, cause I was chasing a girl who I thought was awesome. Mm. She is awesome. And everything changed when I went to that church for the first time. There was part practical experience of the world being really noisy. And I walked into a church for the first time and it was like an oasis of quiet. And then it's part mystical experience where there was something about being in a Catholic church in which the presence of God was thicker than any other place. Mm. And I had a real strong experience and encounter with God the first time that I went to that church. That girl that I was with, she was just, I mean, we could talk about some of the crazy things that she did from an evangelization standpoint. Like, I'll just give you one of them. It's awesome. Like, I was really trying to be a great boyfriend. Like, I was really trying to have her like me. So like early on in going to mass with her, I would just participate. I remember one day I'm like reading the creed with everybody else. I'm just reading the creed. This is what we do at this part of the mass. I'm reading the creed. She takes her hand, she puts it over the creed and she goes, "Never say that until the day you believe it." And then picked her hand back up.
Wow. And
kept going. I mean, just, you know, she was straight shooting. When we first started dating, she opened up to 1 Corinthians and she was like, "This is love. This is what love looks like. This is what love means. So if you love me, this is what you need to study. This is what you need to understand what love means. And it also means this." And she hands me this like little Theology of the Body pamphlet and like not subtle, just straight up. She's like, "This is what I believe. This is what I think. This is what the truth is. And I know that you care about me. So I want you to learn it." We were reading Thomas Aquinas. We were reading all kinds of stuff. Out of friendship, out of trying to be a good boyfriend. And then when things didn't work out with her, I had all of these experiences within the context of the Catholic faith. I had this attraction to the mass and I ended up coming to the church in 2012. So when I was 21 years old, I came into the church. I thought I was going to be a sports broadcaster, do play-by-play for the New York Mets. One of the most abysmal franchises in all of sports.
Tough year for the Mets.
Hey, man, they're on like a 6-game winning streak.
I know, but you saw the beginning, like the fans were going through it.
I mean, we were. I was like 0-5, I think it was.
And that, I mean, I just remember seeing the video where there was literally like 75 people in the stands. Yeah. But that's great to hear about 6-game winning streak. I don't keep up with it enough to know that. So I apologize for misspeaking. I retract my statement.
You know, I forgive you.
Thank you. On behalf of the Mets.
As I teach my kids, when someone apologizes, you look them in the eyes and say, "I forgive you."
Thank you. That means a lot. And I appreciate you modeling the behavior that you're teaching. So
yeah, I mean, just like I'm modeling it with you, just like I model it with my kids. No
exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
But yeah, man, so I thought I was going to become a sports broadcaster. I was doing play-by-play. I was doing my thing, and then I don't know if you know this about the sacraments, but they're actually are real and they're impactful. Mm-hmm. And God kind of flipped my world upside down and sort of called me into ministry, and then found myself at Dynamic Catholic, met my wife there. We have 2 kids, we've got 1 on the way, and has propelled me into all these just awesome, beautiful experiences in life and in ministry and in the nonprofit world. Got to meet the great Nathan Crankfield, a man unlike any other. So is that a good enough overview? Did you want me to talk about anything in particular?
I think that was beautiful. I think that was really great. And you worked at Dynamic Athlete for how long?
Just shy of 9 years.
Okay. I was going to guess 10. So I thought it was close, just around a decade.
Yeah.
So that's amazing. So I think that was a very, very thorough overview. So I appreciate you going through that.
High watermarks.
Yeah. And so tell us a little bit about this, kind of segue us into our topic for the day, but tell us about what you've been doing since you transitioned out of Dynamic Catholic. And I don't want to spoil it, but you tell us about some of the things you've been doing most recently.
Yeah, I'm excited to tell you about it, Nathan. Yes. you don't want to spoil it, or you don't really know what it is. You know,
I have a rough idea. I could give you like the typical like father-in-law level explanation of what you do, you know.
Yeah.
The spouse level for sure. But I could give you like a typical like boomer parents overview of.
I'm pretty sure my father-in-law would be like, he puts food on the table.
That's right. He got a couple different things going on. I don't know. He speaks. Yeah.
Yeah. So I founded and run something called the Catholic Mentor. I was certified by the Catholic Psych Institute in this model of accompaniment called Applied Personalism. It sort of takes authentic Catholic spirituality, John Paul II personalism philosophy, combined with sound psychology, and applies it into direct one-on-one accompaniment with people. So it's not counseling, it's not therapy, it's not spiritual direction. It's just better than all of those things. It is an integrated approach to walking with people in their journey, removing obstacles between them and God, helping them find God's will in their lives, but also overcoming, you know, mental and emotional obstacles. People that I work with come to the Catholic Mentor because they want to make decisions, because they don't know how to make a decision. They don't know how to follow what God is inviting them to do. It's kind of confusing time, or they come to the Catholic Mentor because they're struggling with a clear obstacle in their life, like a really bad relationship or like a bad addiction or just a terrible obstacle. Or they come because they're in emotional distress and they're trying to overcome something that happened in their past or that's happening currently. So it's a gift to be able to walk with people in that one-on-one context. And it's also just amazing because I literally have, every time I think I'm going to do something that's going to change someone's life, it basically has no effect. I feel like I'm tossing an elephant into a pool and it's like blip. And then every time I like do something that's totally innocuous and seems like not meaningful at all, it's like God's grace just does something absurd in somebody's life. So it's a really humbling thing to do. And it's really cool, especially after spending so many years and like trying to serve everyone all at once, to be back into a place that's like one-to-one, heart-to-heart, person-to-person. It's been great.
That is really cool. I love it. Well, that segues us into our topic for today, which is, I guess you could call it bad therapy. I don't know if that's the right approach. An assessment of Abigail Schreier's critique of bad therapy.
Yeah.
From the Catholic perspective, that's kind of what we're going to go through. And I'm sure a lot of people have seen some of her content. For those who don't know who Abigail Schreier is, she was first the author of Irreversible Damage, which was kind of like a groundbreaking book. I mean, I think about that one with like Ryan Anderson's When Harry Became Sally, like these kind of early critiques of the transgender movement, especially the way I think Abigail especially emphasizes the way that it preys upon young women, encouraging them to transition to be boys or the body mutilation and all the kinds of things that go along with that. I've listened to many of her different types of content, from interviews to speeches she's given. I have Irreversible Damage, has not read it yet. It's been on my list for like 2 years, and I keep pumping it down, but I do listen to her a fair bit. One of my favorite speeches ever was a speech she gave at Princeton that she re-recorded. I'm pretty sure it was Princeton or Harvard, but she re-recorded it for the Honestly podcast. I don't know if you know Barry Weiss and the Honestly podcast, but
yeah,
she re-recorded it for there. Well, I guess, yeah, I think Barry was on the article you sent me with Abigail. So Yeah, so that's kind of an overview of Abigail Schreier. I don't think she would identify. I don't know if she's Christian or not. I don't know that she even would fully identify as conservative. But she does have these critiques of a lot of things that people would consider woke or progressive, a lot of modernist ideas. And so we wanted to talk about some of these critiques about therapy from the Catholic perspective, to see, yeah, just kind of talk about some of the problems that she mentions and see if, yeah, how they line up with what the church teaches and some of the stuff that you're doing. So, yeah, is that, do you feel like that's a fair overview of the topic?
Yeah, well, I think what's made it so popular and such an important issue for people is that there's all this attention around schools and education right now. And there's all this attention about schools are sort of the battleground for the hearts and minds of children. And so there's lots of stuff obviously being done around around gender dysphoria and gender confusion and trying to indoctrinate a specific way of viewing the world and indoctrinate a specific way of viewing the human person that is destructive to the human person. What's been great about Abigail is every time I've heard her talk about anyone who's religious, she kind of mocks them. And it gives her a certain amount of street cred because she's literally just coming at it from a journalistic perspective, which is, okay, there's an increase of 4,000% in teenage girls having gender dysphoria and seeking transformation in the gender. Like, that's insane. And she kind of traces the origins of that all the way through, and she doesn't do it in irreversible damage, but bad therapy is really the sequel to irreversible damage, because you land on the core of it, and the core of the problem is that you've essentially had parents abdicate their role and their power to form the mental side of children over to therapists and the schools. And now parents are seeing the fruits of that. Like, kids aren't practicing the faith. They're getting indoctrinated on a number of social issues, from homosexual relationships to gender issues to all kinds of stuff. Suicide rates are going crazy through the roof. You've got 1 in 3 teenage girls who have seriously thought about suicide. And parents are like, what is happening? I gave my children to these experts, and they're giving them back to me broken, weaker, faithless, caught up in the culture. Like, something isn't right. And then she writes Bad Therapy, and she's like, yeah, it's bad therapy. It's the problem. Parents need to take back responsibility. And I think that's a message that parents want to hear, that they can trust themselves, that they can trust their instincts. And that a return to parents being the authority over the life of the child is what's needed for the health of the child. It's not just selfish for the parent. And I think that's been really resonating with people. I'm sure it resonates with you, right? Like, I'm sure you're not looking at Jordan being like, I hope somebody else other than me has the most influence on his life or teaches him about what it means to be a man or a woman, you know?
Yeah. For sure. I mean, I thought I just finished the Abigail Jordan Peterson episode, and then I listened to a few clips of her episode with Joe Rogan. I know she was on The Spillover with Alex Clark. For my Alex Clark fans out there, shout out to Emily, who's like Alex Clark's biggest fan. but yeah, Jordan had this quote in there, and I don't know, I didn't memorize it word for word, but I took a screenshot of the timestamp because I was driving, and I was like, I want to come back to this because it might be like my new favorite quote on fatherhood. He was basically saying that he told his son-in-law when his daughter had their child, he said, if you have like any dad that has any sense or awareness or like cares even a little bit, you have the ability to have the best possible relationship that anybody can have with any human being with this child. That this child wants more than anything to have a very strong, very impactful, very close relationship with you. And it was just really moving to me to hear that, to hear somebody say, you know, because you get this, and I speak against this, you speak against this, like Homer Simpson kind of attitude amongst dads, and dads don't really matter. Dads are idiots, right? Toxic masculinity, all the things. And so to hear like him actually just say like, this child, because especially when you have, I think, really young children, you're kind of getting into that, you know, the young ages where they probably do, you know, engage with you a lot more. And once they get out of kind of that like clinging to mommy phase, especially the boys, I think do transition into this like really looking up to their father. But in those early stages, it's easy to feel not as, you're not as needed. So you're not just feeling not as needed, but you're like objectively not as needed, at least in their eyes. And then you have this kind of transition into that. And I'm starting to see it more and more now as Jordan's turning one. But just hearing that, you hear that about how important our relationship is. We know as Catholics, right, the important role of the husband, of the father. And then just to think about how many people just abdicate that responsibility, how many people just give that over to somebody else who does not have their child's best interest in mind is really sad. And I think we're getting into this phase now. And I think the same thing's going to happen. I've talked about this with same-sex marriages and all these things that are happening to these young kids, not just same-sex marriages, but those who are adopted by same-sex parents, that we're now getting a lot of these people who have gone through these social experiments we've done that have never happened before in human history, that they're getting of age where they're becoming adults. And they're a lot of them, not all of them, but you have people who are starting to be very resentful, the detransitioners, right? Who are like, I can't believe my parents allowed this to happen to me. And the good-willed parents, you know, who actually are just ignorant and just going along with it and just trying to do what's best and are like bamboozled by culture, society, and the so-called experts, I think do have a lot of guilt and shame and regret about allowing it to happen and giving their responsibility for their child over to these people. But you do have some that are just, you know, as Jordan Peterson is very harsh on them, just calls them like massively narcissistic, which a lot of them are. And they're really looking out for what they think is best for them. You see it a lot in athletes and Hollywood, you know, where they have four kids and all four of them are somewhere in the LGBTQIA plus spectrum. It's really sad to see. But
well, I think what you touch on, and Abigail Schreiber doesn't talk about this in the book, and I would argue really strongly, and I bet if you pressed him on it, Jordan Peterson would as well, is that just from a technical relational dynamic perspective, so much of this comes down to a problem of not necessarily poor parenting or bad therapy. It is weak fatherhood. Mm-hmm. It is a duplication of Adam letting the snake get into the garden.
Yep.
And it's fathers. So like if you just from a psychological perspective, a strong integrated perspective is that in general, this is not true for literally everyone, but in general, it is a dominant trend that women prioritize relationship and relationality and things being good within the context of the relationship. And they would prioritize the state of the relationship being good over causing a rupture, even if it causes them harm. And part of that is really good because it's like a female has a natural instinct. I'd rather feed my baby all night than get sleep. Because mm-hmm. if I were to not do that, it would cause pain to my child. So like there's really practical biological reasons for that and all that stuff. The dad's role, the man's role in the context of the children is to help the woman in particular, like be okay with rupturing the relationship. Be okay with the child
risking that
being happy, at least risking it. Yes.
Right.
Like being okay with that for a greater good. So like the context of it being, you know, your kid comes to you, and they're like, you know, I don't really want to go to school today. You know, like my tummy hurts. And mom, appropriately, feminine genius, wants to receive that. And she's like, honey, tell me about it. You know, what's wrong? Like, how are you? Let me listen to you. Let me understand you. Right. And you know, dad in the corner over here is like, he just doesn't want to go to school. Like, what does he have? Does he have a test today? You know?
Yeah.
And so it's brilliant because you need both. You need the feminine genius. You need to seek to understand, and men need to grow in that, no question. But women also need to grow and need to have that masculine genius that comes in and says, like, hey, bud, you look okay. You sound okay. You know, if something happens at school, I'll come pick you up, but we're going to school today. And he cries and he's upset and he's, and mom's like, oh, my heart's breaking. And dad's like, I got it. Let's go. Right?
Yeah.
Man. Dads have stopped stepping in. Dads have stopped stepping in and being like, no, this is wrong and this is unacceptable. Like, no, you can't wear the mini skirt that high. Like, no, you can't. I don't care if you slam your door and go inside and don't talk to me for a week. I don't care. I care more about you than I care about the relationship being harmonized right now. And I think that's so much of what, where the problem is at. Like, men have stopped actually speaking. They've stopped risking rupture. They've gotten to a place in which they play this secondary parental role, and they've stopped giving the gift to their wives or their kids, the masculine genius, which is truth sometimes trumps relationship temporarily.
Yeah.
Like, in the long run, it's better for the relationship, right? But like,
you can't be good all the time.
Yeah, you rip your kid from, they're running out in the middle of the street, you rip them out of the middle of the street, right? This is the primary example. You pull them out. They're like, ow, you almost ripped my arm off. And you're like, yeah, but you're not dead.
Right.
Like, you're going to thank me for it.
Which is a better alternative. What 100%. What do you think is the starting point? Like, what do you think? I have an idea, but I want to hear your thoughts on it. What do you think is a cause? And there's not just one, but what do you think are some of the causes as to why men have stopped playing that role?
I mean, there's lots of them. I think one is our generation of fathers, their dads, so like our grandfathers, they dominated women, and they were overly dominant, inappropriately dominant. They never received any of the feminine genius. And so they separated themselves from their kids. They really separated themselves from the home. They were much more command and control. They were command and control in the office. They were command and control in the home. And our dads experienced that and how crummy that was. They're like, I'm not going to do command and control. Like, I'm going to be there. I'm going to listen. I'm going to let like woman take the lead. I'm not going to be argumentative. I'm not going to be confrontational. And I think, and then they pass that on to their sons, this sort of mild mannered, passive, I can't stand up to my wife masculinity. And now like you and I are like, well, how am I, this is crazy. You know, like, what am I supposed to do here? Like, how do I have a conversation of conflict with a woman? How do I help her feel heard and understood, but also be like, let's not do that. I mean, for example, you're pretty close to this, but like, when a woman first has her baby, the first 3 months after having a baby, hormones are intense. And the cross that she has to carry is intense.
Yep.
There's almost no ability to look at a situation logically. And like, that's not a criticism. That's not a judgment of any kind. But like, that's one of the prime periods for a man to lead. Be able to be like, honey, I know you're really upset about that. I know you're really doing this. You know you're really doing that. Like, but I think this is the best way forward. And I think this is what we need to do. And this is what we're going to do. And I'm going to take care of this. And I'm going to take care of this for you. I remember having that specific conversation with my wife, who thought that she was going to spend the whole night sleeping on the floor next to my son's crib. I was like, that's not what we're doing. Like, there's a much better way. And like, you can't do that.
That's not what we're
and
doing.
I love you too much to let you do that. And that's, you know, amazing. In the moment she was like, I need to be with my son. You know, she was like going for it. But once things settled down, she was like, I'm so glad you did that. Like, thank you. Thank you.
Yeah.
And we've lost the ability to model that. And then you throw on top of that just the culture just crapping on masculinity, thinking that if men are left as men, we're going to be command and control and just we can't control our sexual urges and we'll just try to dominate everything and all this stuff. And it's like, no.
Yeah, it is all really wild. I think you're spot on with that, too. I think the generations plays a huge factor in it. Another one for me is I think that, and this goes along with all this stuff, and this is what I think therapy really gets wrong, is I've just had so many arguments and conversations with people, especially people on the internet. I always think it's so fun when I like comment on random reels and stuff. Like there was one bro from like 2 months ago, like, and my comment got like 2 likes, and now like it's just been like popping off in the last week. And I was like, why are people even seeing this? But it was about there was one that was about a guy got a vasectomy, and I was basically like, my comment was, tip for men, don't castrate yourself. And like ignored for a while, and then finally like it just got revived, and like all these people arguing with it, and just like in my arguments with people on wide variety of different types of topics, the main thing I think it comes down to a lot of this stuff is that just like nothing is wrong anymore. Mm. Like there is no morality. And I think it's a symptom or an effect of relativism, where it's just like there's no universal truth. But I think that is such a factor in everything that takes place in our society and all the things that we have in these like generational issues that we have now, is that nothing is ever wrong. And so there really almost is. We've gotten to this point where the fathers used to think it was bad and it was wrong for their daughters to dress, you know, promiscuously. But now it's just like, it's just like everybody does it. Like, what's wrong? What's the big deal with it? Yeah, they're going to be sexually active. We're just going to put them on birth control. If they don't have birth control, they have abortion. It's not going to really affect anything. None of that's wrong. Everything's fine. It doesn't make a difference, right? And people can't seem to understand that. These conversations, these comments, and they go back and forth, and it's just like, the defense is always just like nothing is ever wrong. I just got pushed back. I don't know if you saw my comments recently on the Kelce brothers. I was talking about Travis Kelce pouring the beer all over himself when he took his, it was a fake graduation, whatever. I get it. It was a podcast, you know, event, but still just the image of him standing there next to the president or whoever it was, these officials at the school who are handing him his diploma in their full graduation garb. Right. Or I even compare it as well to like Jason Kelce doing the exact same thing, pouring beer all over himself, bare chested, screaming at the top of his lungs in the stands. It's so cool. Jason Kelce's drinking beer with fans. And I'm like, he has 3 daughters at home who are probably watching Uncle Travis's game right now and see, oh, there's daddy. And this is how he behaves. And everybody's just like, oh, it's fine. He's just letting loose. He's just having fun. And my issue with all of it is just like, you can think back, and this probably isn't your favorite athlete reference, but you know he's one of my favorite athletes. I was like, can you ever imagine Derek Jeter was a partier? Derek Jeter was a playboy. I can't fathom him being bare-chested at a Jets game or a Giants game, screaming at the top of his lungs, pouring beer all over his face. You know, it's just like we had, and even Michael Jordan, right? And Tiger Woods, who had his own issues and his own promiscuous lifestyle, they still at least publicly attempted to be some form of a role model and to keep themselves together. What you do privately doesn't mean that it doesn't matter for your soul. It certainly does. But at least we had this respect that it was like, if you did that kind of stuff, you do it at a party in your backyard, whatever, but you wouldn't do these types of things publicly. And I think so much of it comes down to just nothing's wrong. You like nothing's immoral. Everything is, every type of behavior is acceptable and okay. And I think that's where you really see, even when you get that into the Christian perspective, I watched a YouTube video earlier, which is a debate between a LGBTQ pastor and theologian, he calls himself, and a more Orthodox, both Protestants. Obviously, the first one's a Protestant, but the second one Protestant defending scripture. And it's just like this concept, whenever you get into, I think, cloudy, bad, quote unquote, Christianity, it's when they're constantly telling you that nothing is wrong. And that you're a Pharisee if you say that there is anything that's actually immoral or that's actually sinful.
But people... So a lot of people are listening to this being like, yes. Like, I agree. I agree with you, Nathan. But in practice, we don't. So like, you're touching on a topic that has really fired me up of late. This is why we're friends. But I wrote at the beginning of Lent this article that got the most attention of any of the articles that I've written. And it was, my goal this Lent is to learn to hate. That's my objective. Like, I want to learn to hate. Because I was reading
would,
all these.
That would get some attention.
Yes, yeah, yeah. I mean, I did it to get some attention, but I also did it to see what people's reaction to this would be, but also to express something that I was experiencing across just all the spiritual masters, which is, if your love for God is increasing, your hate for sin and evil increases as well. And like, what you hate is a reflection of what you love. And so they talk about not just hating mortal sin, they talk about learning to hate and to be vigilant over venial sin. And actually learning to hate every obstacle between you and God. So the whole article was about how, like, I'm trying to increase my love for God. And one of the ways I'm trying to do that is I'm asking for the grace to hate everything that stands between me and God and specific sins in my life. Because, well, I mean, that's what Lent is for, right? Like, that's literally the purpose of Lent. I cannot tell you the number of people who commented on that section that were like, God and hate are incongruent. Mm-hmm. And I would ask questions like, why do you think we say in the act of contrition, like, I detest all of my sins?
Yeah. Like, do you know what that word means? Do you know what synonym for the word detest?
Yes. Or with one person, I did this example. I was like, okay, let's say lust was a person. And you came home one day and lust had moved in your house. If you're the man of the household, you're going to find a shovel. And you are either going to find a way to beat the daylights out of lust, drag it out of your house and tell it never to come back. Like, you would kill it before you'd let it stay. Like, you should hate it and all of its implications for your family so much that you would prefer death to lust reigning and living in your home freely. And it was like I was speaking from a different planet, you know? Like, the church doesn't have a just war theory. It's like, the church has a just war theory for your internal spiritual life and the external world. And there are very specific parameters. Lust is a deadly sin. If lust is in your life, you should kill it. You should hate it, and you should absolutely destroy it. Because if you don't, it's going to destroy you in every way. And we've stopped not only drawing lines at all, but like stark, clear lines. Mm-hmm. Hate lust, hate envy, hate pride, hate these things. Love humility, love charity, love obedience, like love poverty. It's simple. Yeah. It's hard, but it's simple. It drives me nuts.
I love it. No, I think you're spot on there. I want to transition a little bit here to talk about the possibility of overemphasizing mental health. Kind of going back to some of Abigail's comments, I feel like she really hit on this, and I want to know your thoughts on my analogy I put in the notes there, because it was something I came up while writing the outline. Was just that, and this it's kind of a spinoff, or I guess like an example of the way I kind of teach people to approach mental health, which is very similar to the way that I approach, and I think that we ought to approach, physical health. So to give kind of an overview of that, and then I'll give the analogy. My approach to mental health is close to physical health in that, to be physically healthy, I think there's three core components to that. You have your nutrition, the things you put into your body. You have exercise, the things that you do with your body, keeping your body fit and moving. And then you have rest and sleep, right? Rest/sleep, not four things, but you have rest. And so those are kind of the three key components, I think, to physical health. And I think in the mental realm, you have the same thing, where, at least in my experience, and I think in the experience of many people, you have the things that you put into your mind, right? So if you're always listening to sad and crappy music, if you are listening and around negative and terrible people, if you are entertaining and even engaging with your own negative thoughts as they pop into your mind, sometimes from Satan himself and sometimes just from your own whatever inclination towards negative thoughts, if you're entertaining and dwelling and chewing on those things and digesting those things, then you're going to have likely have bad mental health. The other thing that I think is helpful is things like learning, reading, philosophy, having engaging and difficult conversations, wrestling with different ideas, learning new things. And these are things that I think really are kind of the exercise of your mind. And then lastly, you just have rest, which I think largely comes through prayer, but also just means unplugging sometimes and not just scrolling on your phone, but doing things like active rest, where for me, like reading could be an example of that. But even just driving home with no music or no podcasts or no audiobooks going, like sometimes it's just allowing your mind to have some time, whether that's to freely wander and think about different things that are just kind of coming to mind and dealing with those as they come up, or to, at least is it's mostly possible for men, to actually just shut your mind off for a little while and just like exist for a short period of time. I know that's foreign to a lot of women and to even some men who have strong cases of ADHD, but for some of us, I know I'm capable of this, you can just kind of shut your mind off. And so my analogy was the COVID thing, because I think 2020 was a time where obviously physical health kind of came back into the forefront of a lot of people's minds. Americans aren't known, especially to Europeans and other, you know, people from other continents and countries, to be the most health conscious people. But Americans really did care about health once COVID came around, at least in the aspect of trying to avoid sickness, which is what I feel like we have started to do at that same time, because 2020 also spurred this huge spike in anxiety and depression. Suicidal thoughts, loneliness. And we started to try to avoid getting sick rather than striving to actually be healthy. And what does that mean to me? That means when I'm on a flight and I see somebody who is massively obese, who, you know, or you're at Walmart, you see somebody who's massively obese and they have cigarettes in their pocket, but they have a face mask on so they don't get COVID. And I think that is, you know, the type of person who's getting their every vaccine, they're getting their boosters, they're overweight. But all their only thing, they use their hand sanitizer. Nothing else in their life resembles anything about caring about nutrition, exercise, or rest, any other aspects of actual health. They don't have any striving or anything in their life where they're striving to actually be healthy, but everything is geared towards not getting sick. And I think that we have kind of that same obsessive mindset with mental health and some of these emotions, check-ins constantly, and all this stuff is just like, we just want to avoid, and even going back to the helicopter moms, we just want to avoid people being sad. You should never have any negative feelings or emotions. And if we can avoid that, we'll be good. And in trying to avoid that, we plunge ourselves more deeply into it. That was a lot of words, but what are your thoughts on my either my approach to mental health or my COVID example or both?
Well, I like it, but maybe not for the reasons that you intended the analogy to play. Mm. So if you... like if you think about the world of mental health and what's been going on in the last 25 years, let's say, like it has gotten precipitously worse every single year. Some years big jumps versus others. It has gotten worse every year, while the number of resources that are available and the number of people in therapy and the number of people who are open to receiving mental health support has gone up precipitously every single year. So in every other area of the medical community, it's like when there are more resources, when there's more research, when there's more awareness, and when there's more care, everything gets better. It's like breast cancer death rates have gone way down since awareness and research and different innovative approaches have been inserted into the culture. Mm-hmm. Like over the same 25-year period, breast cancer has gotten way better. Mental health has gotten way worse. They've both been talked about quite a bit. It's like, well, more than ever. Why? Like, why? And part of it is like, a big part of it is if you're going to try to treat the human person, you actually have to have a good understanding of what the human person actually is. And so what you're talking about is like, in COVID, a lot of people tried to put a Band-Aid over it. They wanted a quick fix, regardless of any potential ramifications, real or imagined, right? Like when they did that vaccine, did everybody really know what the ramifications of that vaccine were going to be over the long haul? It's hard to say. Probably not. When they did the shutdown, do you think that they really knew what they were doing? Like, not
didn't
real.
Feel like it.
Right? No, not real.
Didn't feel like it at the time. Doesn't feel like it afterwards.
It doesn't feel that way. You know, maybe there are people who know more than I do who can explain it to me, but it doesn't necessarily feel like they understood COVID and they understood what was happening with COVID and they were applying the exact remedy that was required for COVID. It's the same thing when it comes to mental health. It's like we're trying to provide solutions based off of a template of the human person that is deeply and fundamentally flawed. And we know what it means to be a healthy human being. Like, we have the example, we have the template, we know who he is. We can be in relationship with him now. It's like it's Jesus Christ. Like, we know what a healthy, integrated, physical, emotional, and spiritual human being looks like. And he also taught us what it meant to be a human being, which is like, for the sake of your mental, emotional, and spiritual health, you need to deny yourself, pick up your cross, and follow me. That's part of it. You need to be able to do hard things, like Viktor Frankl talking about, if you want to have good mental health, you should apply the principles of an archway, which is if an archway is getting worse and getting decrepit, you put more weight on it, not less. Like, the key to strong mental health is responsibility and meaning and hard things, not comfort and softness and ease and abdication and responsibility of those types of things. I think you were going to jump in. I want to let you jump.
No, that you just reminded me of one on Abigail Schreier and Jordan Peterson's episode. She had that phrase where she said, "We don't make children load-bearing walls anymore."
Yes.
And I just love that phraseology of like, we just, and she even, I think it really tied in as well with some of her words and thoughts on just how many parents nowadays are waiting until their mid 30s or early 40s to have a kid. They have one kid. Jordan talks about this a lot too, where he's like, you have one kid, Jordan Peterson, not my son, where you have one child and it's like, you have to pour everything and you have to get this child exactly right because you can't mess up because you only have one shot, right? So you just kind of overprotect, you do everything for them, et cetera. And it's kind of like kids are kind of like decorative, right? It's almost like a decorative pillow or something that you don't want, or like the couch that your grandmother puts the plastic over, right? It's like nothing can get on this. Nothing can mess this up, instead of being a load-bearing wall in the house that actually can help to rebuild and restructure society. And yeah. I've been thinking about that a lot recently with just like the capacity that men need to have, right? You and I both of just balancing as husbands and fathers and trying to provide for a family and just the responsibility that comes along with that of just, and you and I both always, I think in our lives, doing multiple things, right? We don't just have one job. And even if we do have one job, it's very demanding or has a lot going on there, but you just have this capacity for balancing so many different things and then being able to, and part of the, I think the masculine genius is having all of that, but being you work from home now, but being able to like walk into the house and just like shut that off and just play with Jordan on his basketball hoop. And, just thinking about that capacity of like, that's what I'm grateful. And I think the Army did a lot for me in helping me to become a load-bearing wall. But I love that kind of phraseology that
well, it's used. I know that you also had the example of what happens when you abdicate the wall you're given to
100%.
Right? Like you and in your family, when somebody walked away from the wall that they were born to carry, that they were born to hold up, and how destructive that is for that person. Like, my son was born 6 weeks into the shutdown in 2020, and like he was
crazy.
Yeah, he was really struggling, and they didn't really know what was up with him, and so they just slapped a label on him. He suffers from general anxiety, like a 2-year-old. I'm like, what's going on here? Like, general anxiety. He's two. I'm not sure what's happening. And then we have our daughter Maggie. And all the occupational therapists, physical therapists, speech therapists, the attention that Katie and I gave, all of it paled in comparison to him having another human being that he shared responsibility in like caring for and shared responsibility in upholding. And he wasn't the center of attention. It was like the best thing that happened to him was having a sibling. And you know, Catholics get mocked for having good, like big families, right? It's enormously good for you to have siblings. If you can't have more than one or two kids, like it's a cross that you have to bear, and that can be hard. But the gift, it's really hard on the parents, but the gift to the kids of having four, five, six kids is cannot be overstated, because they have to learn responsibility. They have to be able to be unsupervised and do their own thing and actually have responsibility within the home. I mean, it's really, really meaningful. Because the way that Abigail is completely right, like, in schools and in the context of therapy, they're like, just turn inward, look at yourself, get obsessed with your own emotions, dwell on this stuff, and there's nothing that you do with it, right? Like the way that the church talks about it, like Ignatian spirituality, is like, this thought, this feeling, this emotion is coming through. I'm not going to hate on it, ignore it, repress it, judge it. I'm going to let it go. And it's like Paul Revere, it's coming through my life. It's got a message to tell me. Sadness, or I'm uncertain, or I'm in conflict. I should probably look at my life. And then it keeps going. Or you look at one of the areas at the core of the frustration or the lost or the uncertainty, and that feeling comes back and it grows. You don't go, oh my gosh, my life is ending. You're like, oh, that's where the problem is. God's kind of get my attention. I should look further into that. You're meant to know yourself so you can give yourself, not know yourself so that you can then be the sole source of your own meaning and value and happiness and everything. That just leads to self-centeredness and fragility, and really like personal misery, as opposed to letting feelings and emotions be what they're supposed to be, which is they're messengers. And they come and they move through you and they're trying to tell you something. Like, I was working with one of my clients. He was telling me, like, I got all these intrusive thoughts. I must be super messed up. Like, I got all these intrusive thoughts. And then he starts telling me his intrusive thoughts. And I was like, okay, let's not look at it with judgment. Let's look at it curiosity. And he started looking at it with curiosity and without judgment. And what it came down to is, he was abused as a kid. He now has a child who has the same age of when he was abused, and he's petrified of his kid getting abused, getting harmed, getting hurt. And so he's got all these intrusive thoughts about bad things that could happen and how he's got to do all these crazy things to protect his kids, and he can't sleep at night. And it's like he has this repressed pain, and the emotion is actually helping him to reconcile that, to seek forgiveness from the person who victimized him, to have a place in which God's grace can come and heal him yet again. He has no more intrusive thoughts. And that was like done in a week. And he doesn't have intrusive thoughts anymore. It's like, that's the purpose of these things. You're not suddenly defined. You're not suddenly like, oh, I suffer from intrusive thoughts now and forever. It's like, no.
They have a reason perpetually in order to deal with them.
Yep. Yes. You don't have to wallow in that mess. Yeah.
Yeah. It's beautiful. There's so much freedom in that. I think it's really sad to me how often, especially it seems to be happening a lot with the gender stuff, where so many of these stories are getting out now, especially the detransitioners, where they reflect back on, I went in there and it was just like, it was amazing how fast it happened. Right. Yeah. I just said that I was struggling with this and they said, okay, you're transgender. We can get you started on puberty block, and they get you into this pipeline just immediately. And it's again something that Dr. Peterson rails against, of just like what a misuse of power it is for these counselors and therapists who do this to people. And the same thing happens, I think, in the abortion world. We just had a pro-life rally here recently that I got to MC and speak at, and we had two beautiful testimonies from women. One was an abortion pill reversal success story. So she has a 4-year-old son now. She shared her journey, and the other had an abortion when she was in college. And just hearing both of the stories of like getting in there and just the doctors immediately, this is the right thing. This is the best thing for you to do. You're not capable of handling a child. Like, no, even if you think that this is right and good, that they have this option, just to come into it without any sense of neutrality, right? To say like, okay, let's weigh the pros and cons. Let's think about your options. What do you want to do? You know they don't do that. And the thing that's been most frustrating for me throughout my entire life is both are very financially incentivized to not do that, right? There's a lot of money to be made by by rushing you into this pipeline that says, okay, we've got a hot lead coming in. Let's get you into the sales pipeline. And we're going to literally, like a car salesman, just try to use every tactic we can to close this deal and get this check. And that's one of the saddest parts I feel like people often overlook.
Yeah, I think you're spot on with that. I think one of the things that you put in the notes was Abigail talking about this being the freest society in history. Mm. And you questioning that. And I think what you're speaking to and what that question is speaking to is that we've failed to have an integrated concept of freedom. We only think about freedom in terms of government and external and societal action, which is, am I free to speak? Am I free to move? Am I free to be able to do the things that I need to do without a governing body compelling me to do whatever they want me to do? Am I actually free to act so long as I'm not harming anyone else? And we've sort of put freedom as a box, like in that particular box, mm-hmm. In that sort of political philosophy, societal box. And we've forgotten the inner freedom. Like, we are the most externally free society and we are the most enslaved.
Mm, that's a good way to put it.
Society from like an inner perspective, because like when you think about, yes, abortion and all that situation, it's like, what's the primary thing? It's like, it's the woman's freedom to make the choice. And then the freedom that she'll lose by having a child. Like, nobody ever talks about the cost that she incurs by not having a child, of the mm-hmm. goodness of the child, of the goodness of the wall of the child, and what having a kid and what having that level of responsibility can do for you or can do for someone else if you adopt, and for the world itself. It's like, we don't talk about the cost of you not being free to do the things you're made to do. We've stopped telling people you're made to do hard things. You must do hard things, because if you don't, you'll be a shell of who you could be. So like, I want you to have this child, because if you don't have this child, you'll be a shell of who you could be.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we don't talk about it in terms of that. And I think that it could sound insensitive. It can sound trivial, but I don't think it makes it any less true. At least from where I sit at this point in time in life.
Yeah, for sure, man. Yeah. It's just sad to not give people their true options, you know, and to think about that. When somebody comes to you, of just how can we, better frame that and just be more influential in trying to get that across for society, because it is just, I think really difficult when you have people who are supposed to be fiduciaries, right? The people have responsibility to do what's in your best interest, and they just actively do not. And that's just socially acceptable for some reason now. It's really sad to see. But the last thing I want to close with is just thinking about, I want to hear your perspective on this, because I work with a lot of schools now through my job, obviously, and doing schools partnerships through Hallow and parishes. And one thing I've kind of been grateful for is we had, I feel like, a stretch, especially when I first started in 2021, of there was like this increase in, it was just like such a thing, right? Mental health, SEL, social emotional learning, all this kind of stuff was just like, so we need resources for that. We need to do this. We need that. That now it's kind of decreased. When you ask schools, like, what are you kind of prioritizing? Like, a lot are really focused on increasing Catholic identity when they meet with us, but less focus on mental health as a specific target. I think it's a great kind of secondary target, but as a specific target, I think this is kind of Abigail's critique. It's like, if that's your only thing, then you're likely to miss it, even though you prioritize it above all else. But what do you think, especially when it comes to the public school sphere, but even, you know, in Catholic schools, say you send your kids to Catholic schools, what role do you think they ought to play in forming the emotional intelligence, the emotional maturity of our kids?
Well, I think what Abigail does a great job of talking about is like, when you enter into the mental and emotional space of a child in particular, but of anyone, there's more options of the outcome than what you think. Like, worst case scenario is not that you stay the same. Worst case scenario is that you actually get way worse. I think one of the things that she says is therapy should come with a warning label. And she's right. Like, a public school teacher or a Catholic school teacher acting as a therapist in the context of a classroom should come with a major warning level label on it. Because it's, if you don't understand the human person, if you don't understand what you're doing, if you haven't been trained in it, and trained well in it, you can cause way, way, way more harm than good. I've done a lot of research in speaking with Catholic schools over the last 3 or 4 months, because I'm trying to understand the landscape. And I've noticed the same trend of moving away from SEL. And the ones that I talk to that are really thoughtful about it, they're like, I would love to provide resources for the parents to be able to do this.
Yeah.
And not that we're suddenly responsible for it. Like, the church told parents in the 50s, give us your kids. We'll see to their development spiritually, emotionally, physically. You don't need to worry about it anymore. Now, I think schools are turning back to parents and being like, we can only do one thing well. Educate. Well, I guess two things. Educate and inform your children in the context of the school. That's all that we can do. We can't give them great mental health. We can't be their therapist. We can't be their nutritionist. We can't be their parent. We can't be their primary catechist. We can't be all those things and do them well. We've failed for too long. How do we help the parent learn how to become the way that I would call it, which is unidirectional, loving, authoritative, not authoritarian, authoritative parents, which means you can validate a child's emotions, but you can still have set standards for them. You can still uphold them to a certain way of living and a certain way of life. You can teach them how to understand their emotions in a healthy and integrated way, in the same way that Jesus treated his emotions. But you don't have to dwell on them the way that the whole world has you dwell on them. You can actually have an integrated way of doing it. And I think that's properly ordered. I think as I look to develop resources, I don't want to develop resources for Catholic schools in a Catholic schools context so much as I want to help parents have healthy spiritual and emotional lives and be able to articulate what it is to have a healthy spiritual and emotional life back to their kids so that they can model it and teach it, because that's the place where it should exist. Like, a teacher shouldn't waste it. A teacher shouldn't be responsible for validating the existence of a student. Like, that's the job of a parent. And that's the job of a parent as a bridge to God, who's the ultimate validator of your existence, of your emotions, of your experiences, of your very life. So I'm not sure if that answers your question, but I think that's like Abigail's wisdom is this shouldn't be taking place in the school and this is super dangerous. But where she misses out is we still have to teach kids how to handle their emotions. Because if they don't know how to handle them, like addiction, bad relationships, poor self-esteem, lack of freedom, like it all comes from not knowing how to navigate your own inner world. So if you can put it in proper order, if you can integrate it, if you can do it in a Catholic way, you know, you set your kids up for success, but that can't possibly be the school's responsibility.
Yeah. No, I think that's really good. I love that answer. And I think it leads into maybe a future conversation we can have about just the impact of schools doing all of those things. I just think about it like a lot of the progressive ideas about like government schools should just provide all of these things is just another way that government schools, I think, just ultimately replace parents. And I think, to be fair to a lot of parents who find themselves having unplanned pregnancies outside of marriage and they send their kids to public schools, they're not well formed themselves. It's just like our culture, our society, the government up to the president keep saying that like the government should be raising your kids.
Yep.
And we don't think about schools being the government, but they are when they're public schools, and they should feed kids and they should feed kids all year round. I'm not saying that that's a bad thing. I think it's a hard thing because a lot of the things we care about as Catholics, like we hate the idea of hungry children.
Yep.
A lot of the things we care about do lead into this natural relief of if you're a parent and it's difficult, which it is for most, and the government or anybody else comes through and says, I'll take care of all of this for you. I'll take your kid for 8 hours a day for free. If you need to stay longer, you can stay longer for free. We'll do summer programs for free. I'll feed them for free. I'll do their counseling. I'll do all of these things. Now, they don't tell you what you're going to end up getting back, which is a lot of times a mentally ill child that can't read at 15 and all that. But it just all sounds like a nice deal, right? When you're like, man, I'm really struggling with all this stuff, that the government basically becomes the parent. But we, I think your answer was really spot on, saying that we need to give power and responsibility back to the parents.
Yeah. And I think the church has had to learn that lesson too. So I think we can talk about it in terms of the church.
Because like, it's so easy when you're trying to compete with public schools to say, we got to do all the same things. We need to be the child's parent as well. And it's like, no, you don't actually. Right. You guys actually used to fight against this, saying that parents weren't evolved enough in their faith formation of their kids. And now you're trying to mimic the public schools that want to take even more power and responsibility from parents.
We even apply that logic to sacramental prep. Like when you come to First Communion, like you're required to learn everything there is to know about the faith, not about the one thing that you're there to learn about, which is Jesus is truly present in the Eucharist, right? And then how many people actually believe in the Eucharist? Like 20% of Catholics, right?
Because it was 5 minutes of that one half day retreat that you had.
Right, 100%. And it's the same thing. When you try to do everything, you basically do nothing. And I think the scary part that you're talking about is now it's become explicit. Like you actually can't send your kid to public school in 99% of public schools now, because it has stopped becoming. At one time, it was about, we're going to teach your kids how to read, write, and speak. That's what we're going to do. That's what a liberal arts education is. That's what the point of education is, because as Jordan Peterson talks a lot about, if you can speak and you can write, you are the most powerful version of yourself if you can do those two things. It's like we've stopped talking about that. Instead, you know, we're spending time we're spending time really understanding tolerance. What's become one of the worst words in all of the English language is tolerance. It's really bad. So yeah, I mean, if today I pass the test, that means I get a call back. You know, I'd be honored to come back. And
that's right. Well, we got to take it to review to the committee first, you know, so there's some steps we have to go through, but I think that it is likely that we'll get you back on here, man. This was great. I appreciate you joining me today and you sharing everything that you shared, but want to give you some time to tell us a little bit more about the Catholic Mentor, where they can learn about it and what you're offering there.
Sure. I appreciate that. I'm going to be in your area in June, and I would love to meet your son, and I'd love to meet Emily. So let's make that happen.
Let's go. Would love to. Yeah. That'd be super hype.
Yeah. So the Catholic Mentor, it's thecatholicmentor.com. And you can check it out. I think the big thing that I think that your audience might be super interested in is that the world in June, celebrates Pride Month. And for June, the Catholic Mentor is going to have Humility Month, and we're going to spend 30 days, going through the litany of humility and trying to grow in the virtue of humility and pray for the conversion in particular, of our country. So I offer little programs like that, all throughout the year. In particular, a program that is called Rise, which is a 6-week spiritual boot camp for people in particular who want to level up in their spiritual life. But you can find all that on the Catholic Mentor.
Awesome. I love it. Well, great, man. Thanks so much. And hope everyone enjoyed this episode today. Encourage you to go check out Jack's work at thecatholicmentor.com. Thank you for listening. And we want to just assure you of our prayers for you. Want to continue to encourage you to strive to be your best in everything that you do, and hope that this helped you to do that and understand the dangers of some modern day therapy, especially for parents out there. They can be cautious and be better informed about all of these things. So I'll link some of the episodes and articles and things that we referenced throughout this episode in the show notes. But thank you again for joining me, Jack. Thank you everyone for listening, and God bless you.